So I'm going to invite each of us again, close your eyes. Allow the body to come into a posture that allows you to feel awake, alert, maybe sitting and maybe lying down. But allowing the energies of this practice, which are deeply ennobling, to kind of suffuse this form of ours, inviting us into this ennobling practice. May we find a way, ease our body into a posture that allows us to welcome in this ennobling energy, taking our seats as we are, as daughters of the Buddha, sitting in circle, I like to think, as women have always done. Not quite like this, but certainly coming together as women to be in circle together. And just in these early moments of this sit, again, allowing your place to take your place, allowing yourself to take your place in this global sangha. There's nowhere else to go. There's nothing else to do. No part of ourselves need be left out. So inviting the entirety of ourselves, our experience, into this body, into this sangha, into this practice, into this breath, this inhale, this exhale. Taking a moment again to settle in, feeling into the body, the points of contact of this body and the couch, the chair, the bed, the cushion, the floor, the earth, ultimately allowing there to be a sense of relaxing to the degree that's possible and resting on this earth that is beneath us. If it's helpful to feel into the bones of the body, the skull, the vertebrae, the rib cage, the pelvic bowl, the long bones of the arms and the legs. Again, as this initial grounding, connecting into the earth element that is below us, supporting us and within us. So it is externally in the mountains and the ground, the rocks, the trees. So it is in this fathom-long form of ours, experienced through the relative stillness and solidity of these bones. Like earlier in the arriving sit, I'm going to invite us to keep a good, I don't know, 65, 70% of our attention in the body, resting here, staying grounded, noting the points of contact of your body, the earth, that which you're sitting upon, that which is supporting you, supporting each one of us. And for the anchor, you know, invite us to watch the thinking mind. You know, again, invoking that image of the theater of the mind, settling into our bodies to watch. In the oft-given image of the mind is like the vast blue sky and our thoughts are like clouds. And sometimes it's those nice puffy white clouds or the horsetail clouds. And sometimes it's that incredible stormy, dense clouds, so dark. It's all clouds, right? There's nothing of substance. Our thoughts are ethereal. These arise from somewhere, they pass away into something. And can we flex and stretch this muscle of observation to watch the patterns of the mind? And if the mind is really busy, even if it's not, being able to label, oh, this is the judging mind. Again, watching for patterns, the way the mind wants to judge or compare or plan, right? Planning to-do lists, planning in the future, vacations, fantasy mind. You know, being able just to, as though we were labeling types of clouds, can we label our types, our patterns of the mind? Judging mind, comparing mind, planning mind, worrying mind, fantasizing mind. The list goes on, right? So we undertake the practice to stay nestled in the body, as it were. And the anchor of our awareness is watching these patterns of the mind. Just being curious, oh, left unattended, this is what the mind does. These are the habits, the tone of thoughts, the pace of thoughts. And some of our thoughts will be so seductive or compelling or repetitive that we get sucked in. Of course. Okay. And then at some point we catch it and come back. Oh, wait. Connecting with the body and then watching again that observing stance of, oh, wait. Let me just watch the thoughts rather than either believing them or getting carried away with them, knowing at times we will do both. So keeping at bay any judgment about how we think we should be doing this, you know, that's just more thinking, more machinations of the mind. And being able to rest and just watching, oh, this is what the mind does. These are the patterns. And have fun. Oh, please remember there's no such thing as a bad sit. Come, take our seats and see how it is. In this instance, staying connected to the body and just watching again the theater of the mind for patterns, for tones, the type of movie. As always, so lovely to sit together. Today, as you might have figured out from the instructions earlier, I want to sort of play in this realm of working with the mind, particularly given the context of what's happening in our world and what has been happening in our world for years. This is sort of the relentlessness of the challenges, and how do we work with the mind to be more of an ally and more of a friend of mine said, how do we make our mind a friendly place? And when he said it, it's such a beautiful phrasing, and thinking about, particularly as a kid in my teens and 20s, it's like my mind was such not a friendly place. And at least now when it's not a friendly place, at least I know it's not. and I don't have to believe it so much, but are a capacity to really work with and understand how much we make up. Like, and again, this idea of the thoughts being so ephemeral, there's nothing substantive about them. We can make them feel substantive because of the body can get involved, or the heart rate goes up, get stressed or concretized, or all the ways the body can respond to a thought or an emotion. But wanting to, how do we expand our notion of what the mind is capable of? And this line, and hopefully this will make sense, of sort of the dreaming world, the world that we are dreaming. And I've spoken before about, I worked with John Lockley for a little bit, who wrote The Way of the Leopard Warrior, this wonderful teacher from South Africa and in Zuxu, with whom he studied, to speak about sort of the waking dream and the nighttime dream. From the Dhammapada, to pull it into these different traditions, all experiences preceded by mind, led by mind, speak or act with a corrupted mind, suffering follows. As a wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and what happens? Happiness happens like a never departing shadow. This in Buddhism and in other traditions, this notion of we create the world with our thoughts. This is not to say there are not realities of violence, of course, but the way we respond, the way that we add that, classically called the second arrow, third, fourth arrow of our experience, sort of there is pain is here. There are certain realities. What we add to it, it becomes under our control. And the only thing really we have control of in this lifetime is our thoughts, is the way the mind works, the way we relate to our thoughts. From Shakespeare, The Tempest, our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, we're all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air, and like baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, ye all which it inherit shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind, we are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. We are the stuff of which our dreams are made of. And what exactly is it that we are dreaming? And again, I'm not saying the reality is not real, it is. But can we open up to a more expanded sense of what our mind is capable of? Right? My mind is really good. I just in the sit to sort of watch one of my major mind patterns is planning. Either it's thinking about the stock or planning my daughter, planning. Like, okay. And just being able to watch that, I don't need to believe it. Joseph Goldstein shared this, but in my own experience, if you ever have the thought of like, oh, I want to have a cup of tea, and you might be in the middle of doing, you are likely in the middle of doing something, and this thought comes in of, I'm going to have some tea. And before you know it, I'm making tea. And it was like, wait a minute, what am I doing? The way that we can be so led around, thought led by mind, we can be led around by our thoughts. And sometimes it's a benefit and sometimes it's not. And sometimes it's just like, wait, what's happening here? What's my intention of a day, of what I'm doing? And the mind's going to have other ideas like, no, do this or call this person or do this, da, 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 all the chatterings of things we think we need to be doing. Really? When we can have that pause, that observing of like, wow, there's a lot of commanding going around of things I think I should be doing, things I think I should be doing. And being able to watch that, really, do I need to get a cup of tea? Do I actually want to do that? But to be able to have those pausings to really check in of, wow, it's just a thought, right? It is something that comes out of seemingly nowhere. And the ability it's that can sort of train us to then be responsive to it. I want to share a little bit from this fabulous book, Deepama by Amy Schmidt. And Deepama, for those of you who don't know, was a much, much beloved teacher of Joseph Goldstein and Sharon in particular. And in the 70s, when Jack and Sharon and Joseph and many others were in India, Deepama was one of their teachers. And she came back to the States and taught at IMS. And apparently she's something like, I don't know, 4'7". If those of you who know Joseph Goldstein, he's really tall, like over 6 feet. But she was just an astonishing powerhouse of practice. And I want to share a little bit. So her main teacher was Munindraji. And just for, in terms of lineage, Kamala Masters, who teaches at IMS, sometimes at Spirit Rock, she was also a student of Munindraji. And Deepama came to the practice because there was such sorrow. She was a Bangladeshi woman, and her husband had passed, and I believe two or three of her four kids also passed. And her grief was just astonishing. She couldn't move. She was just bedridden. It's been a while since I might be a little fuzzy on the details, but that's definitely the gist. And someone had said, "Look, sweet, you need to learn how to meditate." So she worked with Munindraji and clearly came into this life with powers. So I'm going to read some of this book in a way to hold. And I'm offering this as when I first read it, it was like, oh my God, super inspiring. And again, this way of like, how can we expand our notion of what's possible in terms of the mind's capacities? Deepama developed her supernatural powers under Munindra's tutelage and never demonstrated except at his request. Such powers are not achieved through insight meditation, but through concentration practices in which the mind enters a deep state of absorption known as jhanas. When she was doing the jhana practice, Deepama could enter any of the 8 classical jhanic states at will and stay as long as she wanted. So I'll just read this. This is a fun part. According to Munindra, Deepama demonstrated each of these different powers, these supernatural powers, to him. The following accounts are based on Munindra recollections. You may not believe it, he says, but it's true. Once Munindra was in his room when he noticed something unusual in the sky outside his window. He looked out and saw Deepama in the air near the tops of the trees, grinning at him and playing in a room she had built in the sky. By changing the air element into the earth element, she had been able to create a structure in midair. Changing denser elements to air produced only slightly less astonishing occurrences. Sometimes Deepama and her sister Hema arrived for interviews with Munindraji by spontaneously appearing in his room, and Deepama occasionally left by walking through the closed door. If she was feeling especially playful, she might rise from her chair, go to the nearest wall, and walk right through. Deepama learned to cook food by making the fire element come out of her hands. She could also change the earth element into the water element, which she demonstrated to Munindra by diving into a patch of ground and emerging with her clothes and hair wet. If she had to walk alone at night, Deepama could duplicate her body by creating a companion for herself so that no one would bother her. Right? Deepama's abilities in this regard were once tested by a third party. Munindra knew a professor of ancient Indian history who was skeptical of these powers. So the professor created an experiment, posted a trusted graduate student in a room where Deepama was meditating to watch and make sure she didn't leave the room. On the appointed day, the student verified that Deepama never left her meditation posture, yet at the same time, she appeared at the professor's office 10 miles away and had a conversation with him. I'm going to read a little more just because this is, I love this stuff and the capacity that she had. Well, I'll read a little more. We're okay on time. Deepama and Hema once used their extraordinary powers in tandem to move a bus. One afternoon in Rangoon, they were waiting at a bus stop. When the bus finally arrived, over an hour late, they realized they were going to miss their engagement some distance away. Because it was important to arrive on time, they both began to concentrate and got the bus back on schedule. They made resolutions and moved the bus even while sitting in it. They shortened the time and distance. This can be done. The Buddha did this with Angulimala. When Angulimala was trying to kill the Buddha, he kept running after him, but the Buddha didn't move, and he still could not catch him. This was because the Buddha used his powers to make the distance always the same. A Burmese diplomat was about to become the new new Secretary General of the UN. Manindra, knowing that U Thant would give an acceptance speech, asked Dipama to go into the future and remember the content. She recited the speech, and Manindra recorded it a month later. According to Manindra, he gave that exact speech. This is from Michelle McDonald, a beloved teacher, lives in Hawaii. Dipama said she could go back in time to the time of the Buddha and listen to his sermons. When I asked her how she did this, she smiled and said, "I went back, mind moment by mind moment." I must have looked stunned because she smiled and said, "Oh, you don't have to do that for Nibbana to happen." And then she laughed and added, "It was really fun. It just takes a lot of concentration." The look in her eyes when she said this, she looked so free and so pure. So just a remarkable life that this woman led and that we know, and certainly, and actually Sharon Salzberg's doing an online course about Dipama and her life. So check the book out. And again, we might not ever be able to walk through walls or travel back in time, but it's being able to expand our capacity, our knowledge, our appreciation of what's possible with the mind. Yes, we can worry a lot and we can get caught in fear. There's been a lot of, sort of cultivation of fear and anxiety in the last number of years. And we can perseverate around that. That which the mind ponders upon so inclines the mind, said the Buddha. Right? We know this. The lived experience of what with our mind we create the world, that which the mind is constantly perseverating about. Well, we know this. It forms the neural pathways in our mind. So think our thoughts with care, right? How do we pay attention, again, to the thought patterns, noticing where the thoughts go when left on their own, and be able to remain curious, is this helping me or is this stressing me out? Am I creating a world where I'm scared and anxious all the time? Again, there is a reality of things. Absolutely. But it's the second, third, fourth arrow, so to speak, of suffering. And that analogy, for those who aren't familiar, is that life does shoot. We do get shot by arrows. There's pain and there's suffering. There's loss, impermanence. But it's, do we add second, third, and fourth arrows to that original wound? And the Buddha, in using this analogy, is like, we have some choice here about the levels and the degrees to which the mind can get coagulated around worries and stress. From the Buddha. And again, we're thinking about the mind, ways to work with the mind. Do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is. The future has yet to come. Looking deeply at life as it is, in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. We must be diligent today. To wait until tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How will we bargain with it? The sage calls a person who knows how to dwell in mindfulness night and day, one who knows the better way to live alone. Where are we dwelling? Where do we allow our thoughts to dwell? In Sharon Salzberg's book on faith, because I think faith is a thread in here. And she writes about courage. In the English word, courage has the same etymological root as the French coeur, which means heart. To have courage, just as to have faith, is to be full of heart. With courage, we openly acknowledge what we can't control, make wise choices about what we can affect, and move forward into the uncultivated terrain of the next moment. And I think in order to be able to trust in the expansive qualities of the mind, or even to imagine our own expansive qualities of our own mind, requires a certain amount of faith and courage. It's new terrain, right? For those of us that might be really good at worrying and planning and being anxious, the imagined sense of a mind at ease, a unified, calm mind, might be unfamiliar. Okay. How do we ease our mind into that possibility? How do we dream it enough such that we can believe it? We can have courage. We can rest our heart upon our capacity to live full of heart, which is different than living purely from the mind, and often an untrained mind that can say, look here, do this, be scared of this, be scared of this. What about that? Who, you know, the ping pong, the pinball machine effect in which the mind can really leave us unstable and ungrounded. So being able to thread in this piece about courage of heart, trusting the capacity of our heart, of our own goodness, as a place of rest, as a place of refuge. I've been talking about the last couple of weeks of, can we find refuge in our awareness, finding refuge in the body, even though the body might be uncomfortable or in pain? Can we find refuge there, such that we can cultivate a different relationship with the mind to make our mind a friendly place, a place to rest, and a place to dream ourselves into a future where we are individually more at ease, where we can individually stop the internal wars and dream ourselves into collectively a world more at peace? So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. And to consider, if you did work with the tracking or paying attention to the patterns of the mind, what are the patterns? Where does the mind go? So the unbidden mind, what are the likely patterns? As I shared, for me, I was often planning. For some, it might be judging or comparing, list making, which I think is planning. And again, just being curious, sort of thinking of the patterns of these cloud formations, these thought formations. And again, letting yourself touch into the ephemeral nature. Clouds, the thoughts have really no more substance than clouds. We make stuff up all the time. Ideas we have. Some are amazing and creative and healing and beautiful, and some are so harsh and rigid and intolerant. Again, sort of back in that place of taking our seat and watching, reflecting on the sit, if it worked for you to do so, what are the patterns in this waking life of ours where we're paying attention? And also to consider, what are the dreams of the mind? And I don't mean this necessarily at night. What do you dream about? But more on the aspirational level, what do you dream about? What's the life you are dreaming? And to infuse this with this idea of that which the mind ponders, so inclines the mind. We have such power over the world, the way we respond to the world and what we cultivate if we're cultivating worry and anxiety as compared to when we're cultivating generosity, appreciation, when we are cultivating thoughts of fear as opposed to cultivating thoughts of peace and beauty, equanimity and joy. And again, it's being curious, left unbidden, where does the mind go? It's the habitual patterning of the mind. And where would you like it to go? Where would you like this mind of yours to abide? In worry, fear, anxiety, some of which is absolutely essential. For our nervous system, we're wired that way, absolutely. And when do we overdo it? When do we lean too far into that particular territory at our own peril? Because we miss that which is beautiful. And letting this question, I'll say it again, linger a little. Where would you like the mind to abide? Where, what's the world you would dream your mind into? Yeah. Experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind, speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. What's this terrain like of the mind that is a friendly place, a place of refuge and rest and trustworthiness? Mind that may not become so concentrated that we could walk through walls or create structures in the sky, but a mind that can become concentrated enough to be at ease and settled. Be a place of a soft landing as opposed to a bully or a dictator. Where does the mind abide naturally? Where does the mind abide due to conditions and habits? And where do you dream this mind of yours to abide? I'll stop there. Thank you for your kind attention. I invite you to bring your energy back into your body.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.